Blog Talk Radio. divine peace and blessings, joy and prosperity. You are now enjoying and listening to the Divine Prince here on Blog Talk Radio Live and in archive, sharing with you in all things spiritual, mystical, metaphysical, cosmic, universal, evolutionary, and revolutionary from a Pan-African hoodoo world spiritualist perspective. Understanding that all is indeed a blessing if you can just see beyond the veils, for it is all just an illusion and a test in one of the greatest divine mysteries of this life cycle. This is indeed my constant prayer, my mantra, my affirmation, reverberation, and my reality. And it is crucial to the very foundation of my understanding, teaching, walk, and works along this divine life path and journey. It is how I, the Divine Prince, make sense out of all that we are challenged with here in our daily existence on Mother, Father, Earth. And it is my personal place of power and understanding. The place from where I begin and the place from where I crystallize and realize all endeavors. Understanding that I alone create and co-create my divine destiny, and I alone create and co-create my divine reality. And so it is, Ashe. Today is Wednesday, January 27th. 2010, in the year of going within, inner foundation, inner understanding, inner clarity. This is indeed, as I have said since January 1st, a year of and going to be a year of great spiritual and personal challenge. If you have been fortunate enough to not have very many challenges in life, this may indeed be the year in which you too shall be put through the challenge. And so in this moment we stand radiant and vibrating in divine, cosmic, universal light and understanding, peace and tranquility, divine joy and serenity, and in this moment we stand. And the ancestors of many nations too stand with us in divine humility and gratitude for yet another day, another hour, another moment to embrace the great divine I am creators. And in this moment we stand, and the multifaceted, multidimensional crystals, atoms, and molecules of all-encompassing creation vibrate with us and for us in divine unity and awareness of that which is greater than ourselves and our very temporary, illusionary earth plane existence. And again, I am emanating and vibrating with you now, live and in archive, virtually, verbally, cosmically, and universally, from the working temple of the House of the Divine Prince, Tai Emeka, Pan-African spiritualist, author, practitioner, and advisor here in the beautiful, historic, and legendary city of New Orleans, Louisiana, where our saints are indeed headed for the Super Bowl, where we are indeed still recovering and rebuilding from Hurricane Katrina. And now we are standing in prayer, in strength, in activism, in action with Haiti in their great and traumatic earth change and calamity. Indeed, we are continuing and moving forward with our special Haitian series, and tonight we will be reconnecting our understanding of Carnival, or Mardi Gras as we know it here in New Orleans, and I will be formulating and sharing with you the link between Haiti and New Orleans as it is with Mardi Gras. I will also be giving a short history and understanding of Mardi Gras, what it is, what it is not. And to do any type of show on Mardi Gras without the Mardi Gras Indians would be a travesty. So, of course, I too will be, again, recovering Tootie Montana, Chief of Chiefs, may he be blessed, and the Mardi Gras Indians. As you may remember, I have previously done a show on New Orleans and Tootie Montana. And, of course, as you know, any history that I give tends to be a little lengthy, so we will have to do more than one show. It will be impossible to cover all of Mardi Gras, then the Mardi Gras Indians and Tootie Montana all in one show. So we will be continuing with that from this show on to the next. I will play a short musical selection. I will check our phone lines as well as our chat room. And if you do wish to listen in or call in with your questions or comments, please know that our show number is area code 347-215-8967. That's 347-215-8967. For questions and or comments, you will need to press the number 1 on your telephone keypad. This will alert us that there is a caller in queue who does wish to be brought on air with a question or comment. And, of course, I would like to greet each and every one of you in our chat room. Why, thank you so much for continuing to be with us and listen with us. The Goddess Way, we certainly appreciate you each and every day, and know that we are with you, battling with you, and forward with you in any and all endeavors. And, of course, Ogun Vincent, we greatly appreciate and respect your being here with us. And all of our guests, please do remember to sign in and join us in our chat room. And again, our call-in number, for those of you who are not online and or who do have a question or comment, that number is area code 347-215-8967. And again, I do want to take this opportunity to send peace and love, joy and prosperity to each and every one of you. And, of course, our callers waiting in queue from the area code 504. Thank you so much for being with us. And our Skype caller, we greatly appreciate your being with us this evening. So, again, I'm going to play a short musical selection, again, in honor of Haiti. Let us not forget the great tragedy and calamity that has befallen Haiti. Let us continue to come to Haiti's assistance and world calamities wherever they may exist. I will be forward momentarily. Divine peace and blessings, joy and prosperity.
Azunke parin legbahe, azunke, azunke parin legbahe, parin legba men la jan kase wosho, azunke vale le parin vodou legba,
azunke parin legbahe,
azunke,
azunke parin
parin vodou legba parin legba la jan kaze wosho azunke parin legba la jan kaze wosho azunke parin legba la jan kaze wosho azunke parin legba vodou legba. m'appelle.
Divine peace and blessings. And again, we will be continuing our tribute to the calamity and tragedy that has befallen Haiti by continuing our understanding and historical teaching of the connection between New Orleans and Haiti. And tonight, I will be introducing material on the Carnival season or Mardi Gras. As we are nearing the beginning of our Mardi Gras celebration here in New Orleans, which will begin on February 2nd this year, 2010. Mardi Gras is typically 40 days before Easter and has a whole Christian connection to it, which many people are not even aware of. And I will further explain that this evening in the show. I will begin with a short piece that I was able to obtain on the internet. There's quite a bit of information about Mardi Gras. I will also be sharing local information about Mardi Gras, which cannot be found on the internet. But much of what I will be bringing to you this evening can be found through very simple research on the internet. So it is documented information and understanding. Now, I'm going to begin with a brief piece on the Mardi Gras Indians because, one, it ties most closely to the African and Afro-Caribbean communities as well as the Black and Creole communities here in New Orleans, but it also helps in the overall general understanding of Mardi Gras as we move forward in the show and how it does relate to its populations here of color. One tradition in New Orleans clings onto its ancestral strength of hard work, persistence, pride, and the yearly renewal of respectfulness to its origins, and that's the pride of the Mardi Gras Indian. In the midst of all other venues of Mardi Gras, it is very easy to often lose sight of the traditions that make up our heritage. Caucasians, African Americans, as well as other cultures here in New Orleans, as well as across the nation, have, some to our detriment, cast aside many of the arts we once cherished. These arts and customs now merely thought as old-fashioned and out of date. This we should not do with this ease, because it is clearly a part of our history, our legacy, and our value as a people, as a culture, and a city. And we must maintain and pass on the teachings and the understandings of these traditions to the generations that will come after us. For in most of the traditions are some of our histories. Some have said that it is also our heritage, and some of this nation's heritage is best forgotten. But the history we dare not cast aside, lest we are totally doomed to repeat it. And that option for African Americans is thoroughly frightening, that we would lose and be disconnected from our heritage and our legacy. The Black Mardi Gras Indians of New Orleans are a unique subculture of highly diverse and complex group of our local population. The traditions of these masking Indians date back to the 1700s. The scholars that claim to know the origins of the Mardi Gras Indians, a 200-year-old tradition, sometimes conflict on the precise history. As a result of this lack of solid path in the knowledge of Indian history, many theories abound. But this much is for certain. The Indians have preserved some of their culture and history in the guise of tradition, and that tradition at the time of Mardi Gras is now an integral part of New Orleans culture. In the heart of New Orleans since the 1780s and perhaps earlier, this ancient, colorful, and artistic culture has been practiced, a culture that, be it known, exhibits all of that tradition with some of the positive heritage and is quite a unique history. The history of the Mardi Gras Indians is a long and hard road, starting in the late 1600s with the Indian village of Chachacoma, which stood quietly and peacefully in our very near the north gate of the colonial spot of what became the original colony, fort or port of New Orleans, commonly known as the French Quarter or the Vieux Carré. The Indians fished in the bayou several miles north and made life as livable as possible. Other tribes did from time to time attack and would, besides taking food, occasionally take captives as slaves or wives. Many tribes believed in this system of acquiring labor. In 1699, Pierre Le Monnier declares his camp Port du Mardi Gras, or Mardi Gras Point, as Louisiana's first European settlers entered the Mississippi Delta Gulf Coast region. And in 1711, a mere 12 years later, Native Indians were first taken as slaves, taken to exploit the cheap source of labor, to clear the area to be used as a port, and to learn knowledge of how to survive in the new land the Indians endured. Some were Chickasaw, Choctaw, Blackfoot. Even then, there was thought of Mardi Gras as the white men of the colony of Mobile formed a Bouffe-Graff society. Then in 1718, Jean-Baptiste Le Moyer, Pierre's brother, founded the port colony and river fort at Nouvelle-Orléans, or New Orleans. Indian slaves are among the thieves, cutthroats, prostitutes, and beggars that were the first settlers. But the Indians were not highly prized as slaves because their love of freedom was so fierce that they would run into the bayou and disappear into other camps, which the French and later the Spanish wouldn't dare venture into. The Indians knew the land much better than the soldiers. They also knew how to wage a guerrilla war 25 times better than that of the outsiders as well. After all, the Native Indians were expert at the silent style of death. Indians were accomplished craftsmen and artists in the use of the knife, the bow and arrow, horse riding, stealth and silence, often lying in wait for days for an opportunity to launch an ambush. The style our Army scouts learned from the Indians, the lessons of tracking prey. A call went out the governor to appropriate Indian slaves for the area, since they were known to be better workers and could not survive in the swamp. A mere year later, in 1719, the first two shiploads of African slaves arrived at the port of New Orleans for sale in New Orleans. Napoleon also used the port for a respite for the slaves and crew after the trip from Africa to give the crew a chance to clean and re-outfit the ships for the trip to Haiti. Slaves were given their first chance in 2 to 6 months to stretch out on dry land. Some would be sold here. Most were held in slave pens all along on what is now Camp Street. For 2 years, things were kept in order as the African, West Indians, and Haitian slaves were trained in running plantations and working there. Slowly, the slaves and the Indians began to understand each other's language, and this improved their cooperative efforts to work in harmony together. It also gave them the way to plan things such as escapes. So it was inevitable that in 1722, the first known escape of a slave from a plantation took place. In the archives, there is no mention of it if he was ever found. One must assume that he was never heard from again. 3 years later, in 1725, archives now record for the first time some known successful cases of blacks escaping into the bayou, aided by the native Indians of the area. It is said that tribes such as the Choctaw, the Seminole, and Chickasaws in Louisiana were responsible for freeing some of the African and men of color from slavery. With the Indians' help, the slaves learned to survive off the land and lived in the forest camps just outside the city. These camps came to be known as maroon camps. Blacks' relationship with Indians would spawn a section of the populace that was frightened, and they would indeed write and state that the last thing that the colony needed was Indians and slaves becoming allies. They were intentionally kept from one another. They had good cause to be frightened, because in 1729, most of the 280 African slaves owned by a company of the West Indies joined with the Natchez Indians in what became known as the Natchez Revolt. It was an attempt by the Indians to prevent their sacred lands from being seized as the French tried to develop their fledgling tobacco industry. The Indians had promised the slaves freedom in exchange for their help, along with 176 Indian braves. The force attacked their captives, but they were betrayed by one of the sailors of the West Indies company that had accidentally overheard the plans. The revolt was put down with amazing savageness. Some of the slaves were beheaded and their heads mounted on pikes and placed on the levees to frighten and warn others as to what would happen if it ever happened again. This show of force was so successful that no other attempts were recorded for 2 years. The French colonists, convinced that all was now under control, relaxed the rules, and the first recorded reference to slaves dancing at gatherings held on the plantations were found in the archives in the year 1732. African slaves were highly valued at this time in New Orleans history, as were the free men of color, for their considerable trade skills. The colony, still under French rule, had a sort of live and let live approach to slavery, so much so that slaves were given the weekend off to earn money and to go into town. Negroes had the first trust of the French, so much that some slaves and the free men of color were formed into a frightening force of mulatto troops to defend the fort in case of attack by Indians. 2 years later, in 1736, Governor Bienville and his Negro troops attacked the English and their Indian allies in the Chickasaw War. Simon, a free Negro who accompanied Bienville, led a company of 45 to 50 free Negroes in that battle. Indeed, trust had been established by the Negroes in order to gain some of the advantages freedom could bring, so much so that in 1744, the Place des Negros, later known as Congo Square, becomes the established place to meet, transact business, get news, etc., openly on Sundays for free men of color and later for the area's slaves as they begin to sell and produce other goods to accumulate money to buy their freedom. These slaves would gather by the hundreds on Sunday afternoons to sing and dance in their traditional style at Congo Plains, now the site of Louis Armstrong Park. And those of you who have been following the story know how important this is. We have talked, the Queen Mother, Sister Tony and I, about the attacks on Congo Square up until Hurricane Katrina, and now Congo Square being completely fenced off. It is no longer open to the public. It is not open to tourists. And Congo Square itself has been pretty much reduced to a plaque, which you must see from the sidewalk through three fences. There's one smaller fence around Congo Square, one larger fence, and then a much larger fence around the park as a whole. Now, it is said that the park is being redeveloped, but the details are kind of sketchy and are not well known publicly. We are actually actively looking into this at this time. We are reinstating or reorganizing our drum circle, which we had in the levee in Audubon Park before Hurricane Katrina, with the assistance of Amp Sir Easy on Facebook and a international drumming cause and initiative. But just in the process of gaining licenses and the availability to drum publicly, legally, has been quite a difficult venture. And I'm not going to take up too much more time with that. I'm going to do an upcoming show specifically about that. But I want you to take notes and remember Congo Square and the importance of Congo Square, and it will help to tie together for you the attacks that are now taking place on Congo Square. But continuing with the story, the slaves had not abandoned their thirst for freedom, however. They had formed a plan, and meeting in the square enabled them to perfect their plan. But this would prove to be time-consuming and slow. They relied on the Indians to help negotiate the swamps and continue to cultivate their relationship with them, even establishing a sort of underground railroad to the Maroon camps where possible. It was at this time the Negroes were very thankful to have such allies, and in 1746, archives began to refer to slaves dressing as Indians as the African Americans began to celebrate Mardi Gras in their unique customary fashion. These were in all likelihood the first known black Indians. Slaves escaped wherever they could and were tracked as far as the camps in many instances. Indeed, in 1756, the trickle became a flood as more than 40 slaves escaped into the swamps and bayous of the state. Aided by the Maroon camps, their numbers began to swell as free men of color. Squaws are known to be in the camps, and some bear children, which are known as mulattoes. 20 years of this went on, and escapes were really beginning to become a problem. Indeed, at one point, the governor threw up his hands and declared, "Where are those niggers running to? There's nothing out there but swamp." In 1771, the free men of color were now holding parties in the back areas of the city and in the Maroon camps during Mardi Gras celebrations, and still dressing with the Indians while adopting their ways. But because of the mass of escapes, plus the fact that some of these Creoles were sneaking into the balls, something had to be done. Now, you have heard us mention the Creole balls before. Sister Tony specifically spoke about the Creole balls that were had during that time, where the lightest of slaves were given garments and prepared for this Creole ball, where they were basically sold off or married off as another form of being sold off to these white rich plantation owners and rich businessmen here in New Orleans, and were actually given a house or residency where they were kept, as it were, and of course master could come and visit them at will without it necessarily causing a uproar within the community. And often these women were kept in a separate adjacent community to the French Quarter or these wealthier areas for the explicit purpose of servicing, for lack of better words, these rich Spaniards and Frenchmen or Europeans, as it were, of the city at that time. And in 1781, the Spanish administration of the city of Cabildo granted a prohibition of black persons from masking, wearing feathers, and attending night balls. And this was their way at that time of slowing down or stopping that process of coming together between these whites and these Creole and mulatto women. This only forced them to now dress and roam only in the black neighborhoods and Congo Square. So in 1783, the Perseverance of Benevolent and Mutual Aid Association was formed by free men of color to serve as a unique form of insurance and social aid to the Negroes. This was the first of what will become hundreds of such organizations that will become the cornerstone of most of the African-American walking clubs and carnival organizations of present. During the next 10 or so years, things remained quiet but active, and the stream of escaping slaves began to wear Spanish lawmakers the wrong way. A way had to be found to stem the tide of the escapes. Then in 1795, 23 conspirators were hanged when the Spanish authorities allegedly discovered plans for a slave uprising from the free men of color who themselves owned slaves. The bodies hung from gibbets and trees for several days along the river. But even during all of this, things were about to get 20 times worse. During the years of 1783 to 1803, life under Spanish-French rule, free Negroes and free men of color were an integral part of the colonial militia, whose peacetime duties were patrolling the streets of New Orleans after dark and the maintenance of law and order. This had allowed them to trade off favors for money and a chance at freedom. But along came the year 1803, and the Louisiana Purchase takes place. American troops march into New Orleans to take possession of the colony. Things will never be the same for the slaves, the Creoles, the free men of color after the arrogant Americans arrived. With the acquisition of Louisiana, Jefferson nearly doubled the size of the fledgling U.S. and made it a world power. Later, 13 states or parts of states were carved out of the Louisiana Purchase territory. The laws changed overnight, and no more slaves were to be set free. Americans acted very nasty as opposed to the French and Spanish. To top it off, the Americans didn't allow any Indians to enter the city. The first sign of real trouble was in 1804 when fights began to break out as tempers flared about whether French or English music is to be played at the carnival balls. New ordinances required two policemen to be present and no weapons to be carried at these balls. For 6 years, things got progressively worse for the African slaves on the plantations. The year 1811 brought the greatest slave revolt in American history in St. John Parish, as an estimated 500 field hands walked off the upriver plantations. But they were sandwiched between federal troops moving down from Baton Rouge, giving chase, and the battalion of soldiers made up of free men of color. They were trapped. Though well organized, they had been betrayed before they could get to New Orleans, with the battle ending in Jefferson Parish in what is today Kenner, Louisiana. The revolt was put down savagely by one company of mulatto troops consisting of Indians, Negroes, Creole, and free men of color. Some of the surviving Negroes and Creole slaves began to tell who was involved in the revolt after repeated beatings. This led to a general feeling of uneasiness and charges of insurrection being brought not only against the actual participants, but any slave thought to be a troublemaker, whether he took part in this incident or not. It took some time to find all the accused slaves, upwards of 3 years. Even then, some still managed to escape north. Because of the fear generated by the 1811 slave revolt, all gatherings by slaves and free men of color were prohibited. This ended all masking by the Indians in Congo Square. They had to alter their plans, routes, and dates to remain undiscovered. This sent the Mardi Gras Indians into deep hiding, but the art was still practiced, and by now the costumes for which they are extremely famous for begin to appear. It wouldn't be until 1835 that the black Indians would resurface in the known archives. The culture, however, survived despite being forced underground by the fear of rebellion after the 1811 slave revolt, and later as the Jim Crow laws of the 1890s, a tradition that keeps alive the memory of two centuries bound between African Americans and Native Americans. The Native Americans and the African slaves share a reverence for the spirits of their ancestors, a strong belief in the celebration of seasonal changes and the use of ritualized costumes. It is a West African tradition to signal respect for one's hosts by dressing like them at ritual celebrations. There is strong evidence that the costumes of modern-day Mardi Gras Indians are a cross between African ritual costumes and that of the Native Americans. This is likely because of the fact that slaves sold here were mostly from the West African nations that captured and sold slaves to the white traders that frequented the coast and at that time in history. The black Indian nation is loosely organized into what was originally called gangs, now called and known as tribes, which labor all year long in some loose, secretive way, creating magnificent suits consisting of intricate hand beading, false gems and gemstones, and decorative feathers and plumes, as well as symbolic ornaments like rifle sticks, staffs, shields, and tribal flags. They wear long braided wigs or wear tied bandanas on their head to shield the headpieces from body oil and dirt. They also wear crowns to be beaded and feathered with their costumes and use moccasin-style footwear. The blending of these cultures has also spawned a new unique tradition. On Mardi Gras Day each year, tribes of black Indians parade through their own neighborhoods singing and dancing to traditional chants, particularly unique to the Mardi Gras Indians. They do this to reclaim territory, and still for some, it is to settle old scores with rival tribes. But the tradition has but one root cause and meaning: to honor the Indians that helped us in our struggle to reclaim our freedom. But there was a dark side to the tradition as well. New Orleans culture has been lively and diverse, but certain held prejudices by the people, white and black, caused rifts. Since the early 1800s, the cultural differences of the French, Spanish, and Anglo between the districts. These racial and cultural differences were passed on to the African communities as well, and indeed exist even today. The districts, the uptown and downtown areas, hold two groups of Indians, the group with West Indian roots and a group with African roots. The two groups of Indians subsequently exhibit their tendencies to show their respective disdain for each other. In the early decades, the two groups would manifest these resentments in physical fights among themselves on the days of masking. There would be gunfights and shootouts, stabbings and hatchet attacks as tribes would meet each other. It was during the times of best opportunity, times when the NOPD, the New Orleans Police Department, the man was stretched to the department's operational limits during the Mardi Gras season, that the tribes took to the streets of New Orleans. During this time of carnival, police were busy controlling the crowds of Bourbon Street in the French Quarter and the parade crowds on St. Charles Avenue. Most often, they didn't have the manpower or sometimes even the desire to respond to calls of violence in the black sections of town. This was prime time to settle up on old debts, scores, and revenge for perceived wrongdoings. Many accounts of wives and mothers crying as their men and sons wandered off were told because they didn't know whether or not they would see their loved ones alive again. Those were the days when the Indians would indeed shoot or stab a rival tribe member. This was a time when if you masked, you were deemed of questionable character, and no one wanted to be around you for fear they would come to harm. Participants were family members, neighbors, and friends. All would find themselves immersed in the lore of the Indians as well as their music and activities and their weekly Indian practices. The secularization of the public ritual parading in New Orleans took many decades to disappear. So much time was taken, in fact, that much of the original symbolism in the parading attire and the unique cult language of the Sunday tribes has been lost or very difficult to retrieve via oral sources. It was during this time when the public began to refer to the black Indians as Mardi Gras Indians, since the best season to catch sight of one would be in carnival season, and prime time to see them was on Mardi Gras Day. Many Indians have remarked that the dancing traditions only mimic what was once ritualistic warfare. They have also stated that the craft of producing the costumes have all changed dramatically in the past few decades. The formal etiquette that surrounded Indian street activities for at least a century has lost much of its continuity and detail, or continuity and detail. In later decades, the disdain finally gave way to a less physical way of resolving these conflicts of who were the best tribes. The method would be who could sew the most beautiful costumes. In the late 1940s, the Indians began to realize that the killing of each other was not the way, and by the late 1960s, the wave of violence has pretty much given way to a whole new form of showdown on the Bayou of St. John, leading to the costume pose down. As to the stoning and beating of costumes, these brilliant spectacles are made of colorful ostrich plumes, feathers, sequins, rhinestones, ribbons, and beads. Each suit represents many hundreds of hours of effort by the individual Indian and other helpers and is worn only one season before it is broken down. This hand-sewn suit contains specific parts. A vest usually covers the chest and back, and is sometimes a dickey is worn around the neck. Under the arms are wings that open up when the arms are extended. Once the wrists have been additional decorative sleeves. Below the wrists, both in the front and back, is a large apron, the last often being the most elaborate. Designs are sketched on canvas patches and painstakingly beaded and stoned into the costume. Each patch or design tells a story and must be in harmony with the dominant color of the costume. The beaded patches, which are the base of many suits, are works of art and worthy of preservation as a form of true indigenous folk art. The Indians keep these traditions alive through great personal sacrifices, as an Indian suit may cost many thousands of dollars. Estimates of material, time, and labor run from as low as $18,000 per suit to as high as $57,000 per suit. Through generations, the suits have become more elaborate. Each creation stands alone as a work of art. It is with a great deal of pride and pleasure that we salute the families of these African American men, women, and children who make and wear the costumes. Although each suit is a spectacular visual manifestation of the Black Indian culture, it is by no means the sole method of expression. Individual members of the tribe exhibit extraordinary skills in confrontational posturing, music singing, and role playing. One by one, dancing in toe heel fashion, each member of a tribe meets his counterpart. Spy boy first meets spy boy. Flag boy meets flag boy. Wild man then first, second, and third chiefs, queens, and children all meet and play out their traditional roles. And finally, one big chief faces another, knees bent, arms outspread, swaying from foot to foot and turning in a circular motion. The chiefs slowly size each other up. This preening proves especially effective for showing off the costumes. Prestige for the tribe is garnered through the beauty and intricacy of the suits, role-playing, and the strength of its presence in the community. This ritualized dance and miniature competition, drawing both from the American and Native American heritage, occurs only when one tribe meets the other. The competition is to exhibit the most beautiful suit. Elaborately plumed and intricately beaded costumes are the distinguishing features of today's Mardi Gras Indians. Each year on Mardi Gras Day, St. Joseph Day, and Super Sunday, with some other appearances during the year, neighborhood tribes displayed their dazzling, colorful costume artistry. The tribes move through the community in informal competition with a call and response chant, punctuated by drums, tambourines, and makeshift instruments. When opposing tribes meet, there is dancing and general showing off, all with a shared pride in suiting up as Indians. Participants in the street theater, with accompanying percussive rhythms, creolized song texts, and colorful feathered explosions, reflect respect and homage to the American Indian and the African American ancestral legacy. Since the tribes have no set routes for their day's journey, whether they meet each other or not is sometimes entirely a matter of chance. To witness this procession, it is the custom to wait, perhaps from dawn, outside the house of one of the big chiefs. Song lyrics are accompanied by percussive instruments. The banging drums, cowbells, and tambourines are customarily called by the big chief. The tribe and its crowd of enthusiastic followers respond, sometimes chanting a traditional chorus of words that have no common meaning and often derived from the early Creole language. These songs, although similar, are rarely, if ever, sung in just the same way by all the tribes, although they lay claim to the same repertoire. The tempo may be relaxed or fast depending upon the mood of the singers, but it remains consistent throughout the song. Competition is nurtured in a creative climate that awards prestige and respect to the person who is able to outsew, outdress, and outsing another Black Indian of equal rank from another tribe. This culture, like so many other micro-ethnic cultures, is highly stressed and, at worst, is in extreme danger of passing out of existence. Young Blacks in economically depressed New Orleans and are therefore hard-pressed to become Mardi Gras Indians, and older members are beginning to retire, leaving few to attempt the skills, patience, and sacrifice necessary to continue the tradition by passing it along to the next person. At best, the culture is succumbing to change brought about by the external pressures of the need to survive modern-day commercial threats and the inability to resist conforming to society's demand for familiar sameness. To be an Indian is a very special calling. It means defying seemingly overwhelming forces and making a stand for individual power. That power is often exhibited in being pretty and in playing Indian well. In reality, Mardi Gras is not the real focus of the Black Indian ritual cycle, which runs for several days and events throughout the year and includes notably St. Joseph's Day as well as Fat Tuesday. The earliest documented parading of Black Indians occurred during Holy Day processions and military dress parades of the century-long colonial era and continued through the antebellum decades. The Indian culture is under siege because of many external pressures. The sheer cost of materials such as textiles and rhinestones, for example. The tedious, time-consuming nature of the sewing and beading. The fading of family and neighborhood support. To these factors must be added the ironic fact of outside attention, which, though it may bring sympathetic interest to bear on a besieged folk culture, tends at the same time to distort the Indian's craft and performance, thereby presenting a challenge to its authenticity. Media and public attention may have an insidiously seductive effect on some individuals who may prefer to mask and parade on the big day without paying dues in the sense of producing one's own costume from scratch. Participants may be encouraged to play to an outside audience rather than maintain and focus upon communication between and among tribes and between tribe members, families, and the larger neighborhood and community. The fact that each artisan operates alone and conceals his creative production until the day of his debut ought not to beguile the observer into thinking that the Indian culture is a purely individualistic one. In fact, it depends for its continuance upon the interplay of artisan family, tribal alliance, and neighborhood. America is festooned with large cities having marginal areas of impoverished and miserable underclass inhabitants who cycle through life known only to their immediate relatives, or in some cases, the judicial system. Though New Orleans also presents some of these pictures, there is more. The traditionally neglected and outcast classes of the New Orleans underground have for centuries responded with counter-narratives, counter-music, and counter-art forms of many types. That is, they have responded to creatively to their condition and heritage. Louis Armstrong was an orphan who revolutionized popular music and became New Orleans' first world citizen. In the case of the Indians, we find a parallel creative response to like impoverished conditions. As there are many biographies of Armstrong, none actually identifies who he is, and in many ways he remains a mystery. Soon, unless a way is found to help, the Indians may well pass from us, and it's a tradition which deserves to be honored, which deserves to survive, which deserves to not become commercialized and marginalized. Mardi Gras Indians are African Americans, carnival revelers in New Orleans, Louisiana, who dress up for Mardi Gras in suits influenced by our Native American ancestry, Heritage and Alliance. Collectively, these organizations are called tribes, and many of the tribes also parade on the Sunday nearest to St. Joseph Day on March 19th, Super Sunday, and sometimes also at the annual New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Festival. There are about 38 tribes. They range in size from a half dozen to several dozen members. And the tribes are largely independent, but a pair of umbrella organizations loosely coordinate the Uptown Indians and the Downtown Indians. I will be forward momentarily with a continuance on our discussion of the connection and correlation between New Orleans and Haiti tonight with our discussion of Mardi Gras. I would like to thank each and every one of you for being present with us, Y, the Goddess Way, all of our guests in the chat room, and those of you who are on the phone lines. Memphis, I do see your hand raised. I will be with you momentarily. Thank you so much for being present. Our call-in number is area code 347-215-8967. That's 347-215-8967. And we will be forward momentarily. Divine peace and blessings, joy and prosperity. Ashe. Divine peace and blessings, thank you so much for being with us this evening, Wednesday, July 27, 2010, here on Blog Talk Radio and the Divine Prince now in New Orleans. And we are continuing our discussion in tribute to the Haitian disaster by this evening connecting and sharing with you the connection between Haiti, the Caribbean, and New Orleans via the Mardi Gras carnival season. Mardi Gras is upon us here in New Orleans. Mardi Gras starts on February 2nd, 2010 this year. I want to also thank each and every one of you for being present and with me in the chat room. The Goddess Way, Ogun Vincent, Shaman Marie Y, the Duchess of Wisdom, and of course our honored guest. Thank each and every one of you for being with us and present, for truly we understand you could be anywhere else at this moment. The President is giving his State of the Union address, so I do appreciate your taking the time to listen and share with us and catch the recorded repeat of that event at a later time this evening. I also want to thank each and every one of you for being present with us on the telephone lines. Our number is area code 347-215-8967. Thank you so much for being with us. New Orleans, Skype caller, Memphis caller, thank you so much, and we will be coming to you just after we share our sponsors. And our sponsors are, first this evening, Confess Apparel and Accessories. Confess Apparel and Accessories, Tiffany Sharif at 8227th Oak Street, offers a profound selection of handcrafted and original fashion pieces, as well as consignment pieces. Again, her address is 8227 Oak Street. Tiffany Sharif is the owner and proprietor of Confess Apparel and Accessories that is located at 8227 Oak Street, and their phone number is 504-864-8272. And please do let her know that the Divine Prince sent you and suggested her from Block Talk Radio. And also Garden District Shoe Repair, located at 3511 Magazine Street, New Orleans, Louisiana, 70115. And their phone number is 504-891-SHOE. That's 504-891-7463. They do all types of dyeing, Rockport Resolve, orthopedic service while you wait. They also do fine leather crafting and repair. And please do let Shawanda Don know that you were referred to Garden District Shoe Repair by the Divine Prince here on Blog Talk Radio. And let us not forget our sponsor, Dr. Joy. Chef Joy is a master chef, master artist, master spiritualist at Flavor Cafe and Catering, located at 1214 North Rampart Street between Governor Nichols and Barracks in the French Quarter here in New Orleans, Louisiana. Dr. Joy's phone number is area code 504-304-9186. And, of course, Zombies House of Voodoo and Marie Laveau's House of Voodoo, respectively. Zombie's House of Voodoo is located at 723 St. Peter Street in the French Quarter of New Orleans, Louisiana. And their phone number is 504-4-VOODOO. That's 504-4-B-O-O-D-O-O. And also Marie Laveau's House of Voodoo, located at 739 Bourbon Street. And their phone number is 504-581-3751, and they both offer a wide selection of tourist novelties as well as authentic African and voodoo items and paraphernalia. And also, the only place that I get my spiritual church supplies is F&F Incorporated. Felix Figueroa of F&F Incorporated is located at 801 North Broad Street here in New Orleans, Louisiana, and his phone number is 504-482-5400, 504-482-5400. F&F Incorporated Spiritual Church Supplies offers sprays, incense, talismans, floor wash, roots, herbs, baths, oils, waters, candles, statues, perfumes, Santeria implements, Yoruba implements, Ifa items, just about anything you can consider FNF Incorporated offers it. Be sure to let Felix Figueroa know that you were sent and referred by the Divine Prince from Blog Talk Radio. And now we're going to go to our phone lines. Our call-in and listening number is area code 347-215-8967. Again, that's 347-215-8967. Memphis, I've just opened your line. Peace and blessings.
Peace and blessings. How are you?
All is indeed a blessing, Queen. Thank you so much for being with us this evening. And
I'd like to thank the listening audience, and I'd like to thank you for that rendition of history on our story. It was really good. Being a native New Orleanian, having attended Indian practices, having attended sewing circles where they make their costumes. One thing, the Indian tribes, which wasn't mentioned, met very similar to the Zulus pre-Shaka Zulu at a designated spot, which is now called Hunter's Field. It's located at St. Bernard and Claiborne, Claiborne Avenue, which was a huge field where all the tribes met on their trek from whatever part of the city they came from. And they did battle there. They did the actual hatcheting, shooting, stabbing. It was war. Up until I was a child in the early 60s, I remember going to these events where the tribes, the Wild Magnolias, the Fa-na-na, where all these different tribes met. It's called Hunter's Field. It, like Congo Square, has a very historic significance, has been allotted to the size of a junior league baseball field with no plaque.
That's right.
That the resurgence of the Indian community pre-Katrina tried to reclaim, at which time the city officials of New Orleans, in their quest to erase the black and African culture of the city and the Creole culture, they were in court doing battle. The NOPD were disrupting the St. Joseph Day parades, masking of the Indians, the Mardi Gras parade maskings. There was about to be a city ordinance to discontinue Indians, the black Indians, completely from New Orleans. Divine Prince, you may remember this, it was caught on tape, when one of the leaders of the Indian tribe, Tuda Mantana, called out to the City Council of New Orleans to stop the harassment of the black Indians, and he fell over dead.
Indeed, and as you know, we have covered that on a previous show, and I'm going to recover that again partially tonight and, of course, in an upcoming show. We just can't do it all in one night, but thank you so
yeah.
much for bringing that back again to our remembrance. And for those listening, I wanted to maintain a timeline so that when we did recover that, they would fully understand the magnitude of that event.
It is not only the black Indians. Louis Armstrong was a great artist.
And contributed to the city of New Orleans.
But he could never have contributed as much as Congo Square.
That's right.
And to me, to place Armstrong Park over Congo Square, to erase the history of Congo Square with Louis Armstrong was an insult. New Orleans, even though it's very compact, it has very large public parks. Any one of these public parks could have held Armstrong Park within a city park, simply named City Park. And they totally used Louis Armstrong to erase the historic value of Congo Square and reduce it to a plaque. Congo Square, Louis Armstrong Park was immediately restored. It suffered very little damage. Being outside of the French Quarter, I witnessed it. I saw it immediately after Katrina. I saw it the next day. I had to walk past it. It had a few trees blown down, some branches blown down. To say that now it needs to be renovated, don't play with my intelligence.
And renovated to what?
You know, to
that's
what?
My question. You know,
it didn't get flooded. It had wind damage to trees, some palm trees.
Mm-hmm.
I walked past it immediately after Katrina. And it was very little damage done to it. In fact, more damage was done to City Park because so many people took up living in City Park in tents and trailers. That the ground, you know, became totally messed up, the grass, the greenery from the cars and everything. That didn't occur to Armstrong Park, which I'd hate to refer to as Armstrong Park because it's always Congo Square.
Yes, yes.
You know, and to erase that history, the history was being erased pre-Katrina from everything Creole, African, and African-American, to do justice to those slaves born in America, that a lot of people don't realize that New Orleans, being a port city, was one of the first touch-off spots that Africans coming into slavery saw of this new world that they were introduced to, the plantations. And it troubles me, and especially after Katrina, even Popeyes then went Cajun.
Mm-hmm.
Please, people, Creoles and Cajuns are two different people. They really didn't associate with each other.
Mm-hmm.
The Cajuns were outcasts from Nova Scotia, put out due to some religious beliefs, some political problems. And they came to Louisiana into the swamps with their own unique style, their own unique food that is totally different from the Afro-American Indian experience. But they were white. Creoles, Indians, and Africans built New Orleans. That's the flavor of New Orleans. The black Indians, they came about through paying homage to the Native Americans who saved so many from slavery by going into the swamps. All of that is being erased. All of that is being systematically erased with this New Orleans, that they wanted to invent, that they started working on before Katrina even happened. The benevolent societies that started a lot of the Mardi Gras were the well-off men, and the insurance that they were collecting was that their mulatto and Creole daughters would get a white husband. That was insurance. would not even get a white husband because they weren't allowed to marry legally. But to get what they call a benefactor.
Mm-hmm. And this was the true purpose of the Creole balls, which I mentioned earlier.
Yes.
In the show.
The debutante balls.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And the Europeans who saw this happening, they started doing debutante balls to kind of counter the Creole balls to get insurance that they'll European, a.k.a. white daughters, can get a white husband. It's a coming out. It occurs when a woman, a young girl, turns into a woman and becomes marrying age.
And let me step in and note, the Mardi Gras Indian culture from its very beginning, more than 130 years ago, was an expression of black resistance to a white supremacist environment in New Orleans. As Jim Crow gained a foothold in the city, the Indian presence in New Orleans, Mardi Gras Carnival, street processions grew more intense and more visible. And in a nutshell, the socially acceptable ritual of Mardi Gras activities in this so-called Roman Catholic city served as a battleground for oppressed, Creoletized, Louisiana-born black men to masquerade in an Africanized version of the garb of their Native American ancestors.
Yes.
Yeah, and to the black men involved, the image of the Indian represented the warrior spirit that resisted European, you know, domination. The maroon spirit, as it were, the mixing of Indians and blacks of self-determination and independence lived outside of white supremacy's reach in the swamps and forests that were too difficult to colonize in the earlier days of Louisiana, providing a safe haven, as it were, and invoking and allowing themselves to be possessed by the spirits of the black men of New Orleans, their Native American ancestors, as well as their African ancestors. And Tootie Montana is legendary for keeping this understanding and this teaching alive through the practices of the Mardi Gras Indian culture.
Yes. And
there,
the suits
sure,
that they
ahead.
Made,
mm-hmm.
The biggest benefactor of those suits, which immediately after St. Joseph Day, which generally falls close to St. Patrick's Day, they ripped up those suits and started using remnants and trading out beads and fabric and feathers to their fellow tribesmen to create a new, they recycled a new suit. Europeans had started coming from England and France and approaching them, wanting to buy the suits to put them on display.
They're in
now. Mardi Gras Indians photos, the news media and the journalists from foreign soil come specifically to these events, put on to photo and put these photos on billboards without paying the Indians, the black Indian revelers, in these pictures for use of their image without getting them to sign anything. They take it across the water. It's discovered by accident through magazines, through travelers. Hey, I saw Wild Magnolia on a billboard in England. Okay, if it was Justin Timberlake, they'd have to pay him every time they use his image on a billboard.
Mm-hmm.
They're stealing the culture, transplanting it. The culture could survive better if they got paid for it.
Mm-hmm.
They can recreate new suits. The lack of businesses that sold the supplies to the Mardi Gras Indians dwindled. The huge Mardi Gras clubs, the parading clubs, such as Endymion, they could get their costumes made in China. The Indian suits are all handmade. This was a skill that was passed down. Hand sewn. Taking over a year to make. Scraping every dollar and dime. Borrowing this from this one, that one from that one. Drawing out your scene, because every costume depicted some part of history on its apron. A great battle. A great chief. An African tribe, some part of their history, even the songs they sang in the late 1900s, when much of the language was just in remnants. I heard on a Cyndi Lauper song, and it's the black man still trying to hold on to the Indian tongue that they learned back in the day when they lived in those tribes. Your grandma and my grandma was sitting by the fire. I could wake my name, I could move fina, I nane. That's the Indian language.
Mm-hmm.
That has been forgotten. But the black Indians keep it up. Here it is on Cyndi Lauper song. From the Mardi Gras Indians.
And I find it interesting, too, in the horror movie, The Skeleton Key, that was the most familiar song that they kept playing in the background soundtrack during the movie, which was about hoodoo, but suggest the connection between African culture here in New Orleans and Native American culture and spirituality in general. But, again, no one, rarely do you hear an explanation of the song, what it really means or where it really came from in the way that Sister Tony has just presented to us. And, again, our calling number is area code 347-215-8967. I'm going to read just a little bit more history here and give each and every one of you an opportunity to call in if you wish. If you do have a question or comment, do remember to press the number 1 on your telephone keypad. This will alert us that there is a caller in queue. And, of course, we greatly appreciate each and every one of you for being here with us. The Goddess Way and Twee, 1968, thank you so much for being with us in our chat room and all our other honored guests and visitors. We greatly appreciate it. You could be watching the Presidential State of the Union address right now, and you have chosen to be with us and the Divine Prince here on Blog Talk Radio. I'm going to read a short blog post dated Tuesday, June 28, 2005, by Kate here in New Orleans. This was the night or the day after the passing of our Chief of Chiefs, Tui Montana, and approximately a month or so before the fall of Hurricane Katrina. The city council gives the chief of police $350,000 and the chief of chiefs, Tootie Montana, a heart attack. June 27, 2005, yesterday evening, the New Orleans City Council held a special session to review complaints of police misconduct during the Mardi Gras Indian celebration this past spring. Just moments after speaking of his 52 years of involvement with the Indians, Allison Tuvi Montana, Chief of Chiefs, fell to a heart attack surrounded by the other Indian chiefs and other supporters. Cries of his wife and other loved ones soon filled the air, along with hushed sobs and worried whispers. As the minutes dragged on and CPR was performed, the crowd began to understand the gravity of the situation. When the paramedics arrived about 12 minutes later, many Mardi Gras Indians in the room rose their voices in a slow and steady rendition of Indian Red. Tootie was then taken to the hospital where he was pronounced dead. Following is an account of the entire meeting. Yesterday evening, the New Orleans City Council held a special session to review complaints of police misconduct during the Mardi Gras Indian celebration this past spring. Just moments after speaking of his 52 years of involvement with the Indians, Allison Tootie Montana, chief of chiefs, fell to a heart attack surrounded by the other Indian chiefs and other supporters. Cries of his wife and other loved ones filled the air, along with hushed sobs and worried whispers. As the minutes dragged on and CPR was performed, the crowd began to understand the gravity of the situation. When the paramedics arrived about 12 minutes later, many Mardi Gras Indians in the room rose their voices in a slow, steady rendition of Indian Red. And, of course, as I have mentioned, Tootie was pronounced dead. City Hall was almost full for the special session to hear concerns about police behavior during the Mardi Gras Indians on March 19, 2005. Prior to the state of the hearing, one man shouted out for the city council to show consideration for the young people in the room. Apparently, they had been disrespected by police outside the hearing either that day or at an earlier time. He said that they better treat our kids like George Bush's kids, which generated hearty applause from the crowd. A city council official stated that everything was going to be well today, which turned out to be a sad, grave mistake. They opened with the Pledge of Allegiance, which a sizable portion of the crowd sat through. During their annual St. Joseph's Night Assembly this past March, police apparently attacked the Mardi Gras Indians and roughed some people up. But those issues had to wait for a long order of business. The chief of police reported that due to neglect over the past 30 years, the communications tower atop the police station is corroding away. The summertime storms are posing a threat to the city's police, fire, and EMT communications. So $350,000 in funds were approved to fix the tower. Homeland Security, which also uses the communications tower, did not provide federal funding for their spying operations. Councilwoman Jacqueline Battelle, who had brought up the motion, almost climbed over her desk to smile and shake the cop's hand after it passed. This established a firm presence of police support, both socially and financially, at the beginning of the session. Next, the city council invited the police to speak first regarding the Mardi Gras Indians incident. They mentioned that there had been some miscommunications regarding the New Orleans police and the Indians. There were no specific repercussions for these miscommunications, but they had added 8 hours of training to the police academy for cultural sensitivity training. 1 hour was to focus on the traditions of the Mardi Gras Indians specifically. They gave no explanation as to how this would affect officers who have already gone through the academy. When pressed by city council members to define who would conduct this training, they explained that it would likely be someone already in the department in conjunction with the Human Rights Commission, who might, and I say might in quotations, get outside input. Following the police, the city council opened the mic to the list of speakers representing the Mardi Gras Indians and other folks. There was a list compiled by one of the organizers, and they were called in order to speak. The first speaker was late, so another woman went ahead. She was a representative of a neighborhood council and self-defined as an activist. She made an elaborate call for respect and cooperation from the police, which was followed by applause from the audience. Reverend Dwight Webster, the missing initial speaker, arrived as the neighborhood activist was finishing. His lengthy presentation reviewed the many cultural and political aspects of the Mardi Gras Indian tradition, specifically honoring the escaped slaves and the many sympathetic Native American tribes who often harbored these liberated people. He spoke about the use of Congress Square in the past 100 years as a black market and gathering center, but the Native American use of it thousands of years ago as a sacred burial ground. Essentially, the Reverend established firm case for the cultural significance as a key to liberatory history for black New Orleans residents. One councilman asked a question regarding the tendency of new residents or those not familiar with local black culture to misunderstand the traditions, which the Reverend used as an opportunity for more public education. Councilwoman Renee Gill Pratt asked why it was referred to as a parade since it has neither been a parade. She mentioned going to the events as a child and described the events as roaming through the neighborhoods. Reverend Webster confirmed that and emphasized the need for the Mardi Gras Indians to celebrate their traditions in the way that they choose. This was very clearly a renunciation of any permitting process and a demand for freedom for the people to celebrate as they choose. Mayor Nagin stepped in at a point to tell his story of watching the Mardi Gras Indians as a youth and his respect for this tradition. He reinforced the police version of the St. Joseph's Night Assembly incidents as a misunderstanding. The rallying call, "Not Under My Watch," was made as the mayor insisted that these misunderstandings would not take place again. Two men sitting near me both called out, "It's been happening," but the mayor continued emphasizing the value of the Indians to tourists, residents, and others. Tourists first, seriously. The next slated speaker was Chief Pepe Tan, who called for all the American Indian chiefs to rise. They stood in the crowd and then made their way forward to surround the podium. They asked for the godfather of the chiefs, the chief of chiefs, Chief Allison Tutti Montana, was called forth to speak. With 83 years under his belt, this man came to the podium and reviewed interactions with the police over the past 52 years he's been involved. Tutti astutely blew holes in all of Mayor Nagin's exhortations by describing the police violence he has seen and experienced over his many years as chief of the Yellow Pocahontas tribe. He spoke about police tightening their billy club straps as the Indians approached and his tribe's strategy to simply walk through lines of police attempting to block their path. He spoke about a cop repeatedly trying to swing a club at his 10-year-old relative's head and the young boy just barely missing a brutal skull injury. His last words is, "This has got to stop," and he turned from the podium, slumping towards the floor. Two other chiefs caught him as the whole room gasped. According to Christopher Burton, recent Douglas High School graduate, two Douglas student activists, teens with attitude, Dominique and Victor, were the first to perform CPR on the fallen chief as the EMTs took about 12 minutes to arrive. These young folks were ready to support the community in its hour of need when the entire city council couldn't summon an ambulance from a hospital two blocks away. The Mardi Gras Indian community pulled together to support Tutti and his wife in these important moments. She was quite upset, crying at various points, "Just let me see him," since others had kept her away from him as people performed CPR. Several of the city council people had disappeared, as well as Mayor Nagin, who I couldn't see anywhere. Councilman John A. Batt Jr. distinguished himself by respectfully standing with his hands folded as many others gapped into the background. Insensitive newsmen covering the event rushed to videotape the chief's last moments until a city official of some type asked them to step back. After the EMTs and family members left with Tutti on a stretcher, the city council resumed to officially adjourn the rest of the meeting. City Council President Oliver Thomas requested a moment of silence and then read a prayer for the chief and his family. Against the essence of everything the chief and the previous speakers had stated, Councilman Thomas asked that now, if never before in the city's history, hopefully this moment could bring everyone together, black and white, rich and poor. He said maybe this is the moment that can bring New Orleans together like never before. Following this strange closure, people filed out of the building, exchanging hugs and unity. On the streets outside, a much different version of the proceedings took shape. A group of young activists gathered in a circle to discuss the events. Several young militant activists spoke against the continuing violence of the state. Others paired up to discuss and comfort one another. One local elder activist clarified that Tootie had been ill for months and had specifically come out to speak against this police brutality. This activist explained he gave his life for his demands. That's dying with your boots on. And indeed, that is dying with your boots on for your community and for a cultural tradition that has survived slavery, prohibition, Jim Crow laws, and attempts by the city to disband or bring an end to the St. Joseph Day celebrations, which I might add also have a deep connection to voodoo, where St. Joseph Day is a high holiday in voodoo traditions. So there are many reasons that the city would have wanted to bring an end to this celebration and this form of demonstration. Sister Tony, are you still with me?
Yes, I'm still here.
Did you have any comments you wanted to add before I go to the phone lines?
Just the comment that the Cajun history have nothing to do with voodoo. Mm-hmm. And in order for them to make that a Cajun culture, to remake it into a Cajun culture, they have to erase voodoo and its significance and the African, Afro-American significance. I remember speaking to you when this happened, saying this is really bad, that the Indian spirits that lay buried in New Orleans was not going to let this sleep, that they had unleashed a deadly force in the city of New Orleans, and a couple of months later, Katrina hit.
No, not even a couple of months later. This happened on June 27th.
So it was August.
Yeah.
Yeah, a couple of months later, and we talked about it almost daily. Like, I wonder what's going to happen. I feel it. It feels funny. It feel the air is funny. You know, you can feel it in the city, like a rumbling. You know, an underground rumbling. You can feel it. And this had been coming. You know, if they take away the history of New Orleans and its African, you know, influence on the culture, it's going to spread.
That's
it's
right.
Going to spread to the history of Mississippi changing, Alabama, Atlanta, the Carolinas. Once they rewrite one part, they have to rewrite the other parts to fit into that one part to make the change. And the African Afro-American experience is not going to be the same in 2020 in the school books that it was in the 90s, in the 80s, in the 70s. The European is famous for rewriting history. The whole deal of Mardi Gras, which is entrenched in a Catholic holiday, has been rewritten to fit. It's pagan.
And many would say that it is also an attempt to discredit African and Native American religious and spiritual systems, which often use deities and celebrations around deities as a part of keeping the spirit of the ancestors and their spiritual connections to higher forces alive. So it is also said to be their European way of mocking pagan or indigenous spiritual religious culture and practice. And
yep.
I want to also quickly take this time to recognize Horizon 5 for being with us. Thank you. Peace and blessings for taking the time to stop by. Malachi's love, we greatly appreciate it. And all of our honored guests, we know you could be listening to the president and his national address right now, but we greatly appreciate your taking that time to spend here with us on Blog Talk Radio. And again, we have about 10 minutes left in the show. Our call-in number is area code 347-215-8967. If you do indeed have a question or comment, this is the time to call. We have about 9 minutes left in the show. Queen, are you still with me?
Yes, I am.
Yeah, did you have more to say? Please go ahead.
Okay, I just wanted to basically, the Mardi Gras Indians are attributed as being the oldest Mardi Gras, organized Mardi Gras, quote unquote, entity in the whole celebration of Mardi Gras. And part two, you know, we need to touch upon the pagan roots of the Mardi Gras crews and why they were chosen to bear the names that they did.
Yes.
Bacchus, Endymion, Poseidon, all of these are Greek pagan gods. Why do the Catholics, being as great as they were in New Orleans at the time, because remember, we have parishes, not counties.
Right.
Why did they allow these pagan rituals to exist in the 1800s when the church was the driving force? We have to explore the union of the Catholic Church with paganism.
That's right, and I will continue that on our next show. I did say at the beginning of the show we would never be able to cover all of Mardi Gras, Tutti Montana, the Black Indians in one show. So, Queen, that was a great segue into our next show. And I'm going to briefly take the time now to add to that. In the Catholic tradition, as well as in some Protestant faiths, the period preceding Easter is a time of fasting and repentance, known as Lent. It begins on Ash Wednesday. Fat Tuesday was created to be a last celebration before the sacrifices ushered in by Ash Wednesday. For instance, many people will voluntarily give up something for Lent as an exercise in self-sacrifice. It is common for someone to try to abstain from sweets, pop or soda or cigarettes, and similar non-essentials in the days leading up to Easter. Fat Tuesday would be the last chance to enjoy the soon-to-be forbidden treats. While Mardi Gras technically refers to that specific Tuesday, the word is also used to describe the period of celebration leading up to that day. This larger Mardi Gras typically begins on January 6th, the 12th day of Christmas, known as Epiphany. This Christian observance recognizes the day when three wise men arrived to honor the baby Jesus, framing the entire event in religious sentiment. So when it comes to big celebrations that have become synonymous with the day, the meaning of Mardi Gras is excess. It is about the spectacle and atmosphere. It is also a time of distinctive foods that have come to mean Fat Tuesday. And New Orleans has long been a tourist destination for its unique atmosphere and culture. However, nothing brings visitors to the city quite like Mardi Gras, and the city's celebration of the events is legendary. And again, I will continue on with our understanding and teaching of Mardi Gras. I will go into very detailed representations and understanding of the different crews, the origins of some of the crews and the symbolism, and the whole Christian Catholic connection to Mardi Gras from the very beginning. The history of Mardi Gras celebration existed many years before Europeans came to the New World. Sometime in the second century during mid-February, usually February 15th, according to the Julian calendar, ancient Romans would observe what they called Lupercalia, LUPERCALIA. Lupercalia, a circus-type festival, which was, in many respects, quite similar to the present-day Mardi Gras. This festival honored the Roman deity Lupercus, a pastoral god associated with Faunus, F-A-U-N-U-S, or the sitar. Although Lupercus is derived from the Latin lupus, meaning wolf, the original meaning of the word as it applies to Roman religion has become obscured over the passage of time. And we will definitely go much deeper into the meaning, the symbolism, the religious connotations and connections, as well as the pagan, African, and hoodoo connections to the revelries, the marches and parades, the deified floats, and all
the Sodom and Gomorrah.
Yes, indeed. All the Babylon attributes that go along with this highly popular and now worldwide event. And it does go back to medieval times. It does have a place of beginning in pagan culture and indigenous deity celebration and worship, which the Queen has opened the doorway to that discussion. So please do continue to listen with us and do return with us on next week here on Block Talk Radio. I believe that date is February the 3rd. Is next week February 3rd?
I don't know.
Okay, I believe it's next Wednesday, 7 p.m. Central Time. I do believe that's February 3rd. I could be wrong, listening audience. But do please come back and listen with us as we will go deeper into the Mardi Gras culture, the religious symbolic aspects, and what it all means. And again, we thank each and every one of you for being present with us here on Block Talk Radio. We thank the Queen Mother, Sister Toni, for being with us this evening and sharing your understanding of the Mardi Gras Indian aspect of Mardi Gras. And we do hope that you will be with us again on next week, 7 p.m. Central Standard Time here on Block Talk Radio. Divine peace and blessings, joy and prosperity. Ashe.
Word of sound and the power, I am them a judge. That I love, that I love.